So without any further ado, and with great thanks for starting the series, Peter Marshall.
Well, it's lovely to see so many people here tonight, and I ought to add to what my host just said. He said it wouldn't have been half as good without me, but I think he's certainly the other half. But it's certainly a great delight to give the first talk in this grand alchemical experiment, which is on alchemy, which promises to be so entertaining and enlightening over the next few months until Easter. And the reason I got involved with alchemy was I wrote a book called Nature's Web, which is exploring ecological thinking and our relationship with nature. And I realized I couldn't really treat that subject without looking into alchemy, so I wrote a chapter on alchemy. And it seemed very crucial because it's related to the human tendency to interfere with nature, to manipulate nature, which obviously we are now enjoying all its benefits, but there are also many dangers. And as I studied the subject, the more mysterious and intriguing it became. And in fact, you can, if you have the eyes to see, alchemy is all around us. That it's in the museums and the libraries. Some phrases like hermetically sealed jam. Everyone's heard about the alchemy of love. You may even have heard about gibberish, but you probably don't realize that it comes from an Arabic. The name comes from Arabic. Alchemist called Jeber, who wrote in a particularly disguised form so his secrets wouldn't get into the wrong hands. And is this... This, yes, you can see it very clearly, it's a little dim, but it is in fact from a book, a wonderful book written by Elias Ashwell, who was a man who founded the Ashwellian Museum in Oxford, who was one of the first alchemists. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Chemical Theatre of Britain, and this appears in it, and he called it the Serpent of Arabia, and it's two entwined dragons, which are representing a fusion of sulfur and mercury, which is part of the chemical wedding, which I'll come into later, which is meant to produce the philosopher's stone. But this itself appeared in the 15th century work by someone called Sir George Ripley, who spent time with the Acts of St. John on Rhodes Island, and it was through Southern Europe that the knowledge of alchemy came from the Middle East. But before I go into deeper search of this particular development in Europe, what I thought to begin with about alchemy was that it was in fact just a sort of wacky science, some sort of outmoded error, a prelude to chemistry. Possibly, as I later, as some say that nowadays, a figment of Harry Potter's imagination. But in fact, I got involved way before Harry Potter into the subject, and it's clear that some of the greatest minds in the Western tradition have been involved in alchemy, such as St. Aquinas and Roger Bacon, Newton, who often seen as the founder of modern science, in fact in many ways was one of the last of the magicians, the great alchemical adepts, spent most of his time at Cambridge working in his laboratory. And more recently, of course, Carl Jung, who claimed that alchemy provided him the key to understand the human psyche and a historical basis for his understanding of the unconscious. There are also, as we will see later in the series, other artists like Leonardo da Vinci and Hieronymus Bosch, who were greatly influenced by alchemy, and even writers such as Goethe and Yeats were deeply indebted to the tradition. And so it has in fact made a great contribution to science and medicine, and made a profound impact on religion, philosophy, architecture, and art. I think it's because the alchemists ask fundamental questions about life and death, about the structure of the universe, the nature of the human mind, and they, in their explorations of these areas, they can offer us profound insights which are still highly relevant to today. So what is alchemy? Alchemy is really, as the series title suggests, is the art and science of transformation. The supreme goal is to discover the philosopher's stone, which is meant to transmute base metal into gold for a long life, and even bring about immortality. And as a catalyst, the philosopher's stone works rather like yeast, that you can take water and flour, wheat, two common substances, you add a little yeast, and suddenly you have this magical transformation into bread, the start of life. And the philosopher's stone is described sometimes as a powder, a tincture, or even a liquid. But I think all people who are creative and do transform nature in some way, whether we're artists or cooks or potters, that we are working in our chemical way. And in the process, hopefully, not only transforming nature to something beautiful and meaningful, but also transforming ourselves. But always in the great work of alchemy, as the alchemists called their art and science, there are two aspects. There's the inner alchemy, which explores the development of the self, and which seeks to try and refine and perfect oneself. And then there's the outer alchemy, which works with external nature in the laboratory. But both aspects are part of the same coin. And for alchemists, the transformation of external matter is a sign of the inner transformation of self. So they believe you couldn't actually transform nature, produce gold from base metal, if you weren't yourself internally transformed. And I think these two aspects are quite crucial, because they bring in a spiritual, a moral dimension, which has got lost, I think, sadly, in a lot of modern science. It's always a very, very disguised and intriguing subject, and often very obscure. And it's obscure, I think, because the alchemists thought what they were doing was potentially dangerous. After many years of studying the subject and travelling around the world speaking to different alchemists, I realised, for me, I think, the key is that the alchemists are trying to manipulate time. They were doing this in two ways. On the one hand, they believed that all minerals and metals grow naturally in the womb of Mother Earth, that over a sufficient number of years, lead will eventually grow into gold. So what they wanted to try and do was speed up this natural process, which they saw taking place. And at the same time, they tried to slow down the process of aging. So there was this two aspects of time, speeding up natural processes within the earth and slowing down the process of aging, recognizing that throughout all life we inevitably grow, decay and die. So they obviously had a very grand ambition to overcome some of the most basic things of life. They saw this as potentially dangerous, because you were probing deep into the causes of nature, and that to do this you had to be pure yourself. And in fact, all the early alchemists were the shamans, were miners and blacksmiths. They were involved with burrowing deep into the earth. They were concerned with transforming the four elements of fire, air and water. And they knew it was dangerous, and that what they were doing was perhaps even sacrosanct. So they made sure that they themselves were pure. And even today in West Africa, you can find blacksmiths still making sure, going through certain rituals to make sure that they are worthy of the task And I think that this link between the need for holiness and for manipulating nature hangs on really in folklore. So why is it, for instance, that runaways go to Gretna Green and get the blacksmith to marry them? Because the blacksmith still has this link with the past. The fact that it is potentially dangerous and can have catastrophic consequences if we do interfere with nature too much. Obviously, in the case of nuclear power is an obvious example. Because it can be dangerous, and because a little knowledge in the wrong hands can be a dangerous thing, the alchemists deliberately disguised their findings. And when they pass them down orally from master to apprentice, and the apprentice only learned certain secrets when the master felt she or he was sufficiently prepared. And when it came to be written down, which in the Middle East was around about 200 BC, in our tradition, it was always in complex symbols and allegories and riddles. You often come across things like the plot of the stone is the child's play is the most difficult thing. It's everywhere, it's nowhere. And so there are many layers of meaning in alchemy, and I think often that even myself and my book in talking to you tonight, I may be conveying truths which I myself don't comprehend. In the same way a singer can pick up songs and learn from a previous generation and pass them on, even though the singer can't actually completely understand the meaning of the song. But that's enough as a preliminary. I just want to give you just some of a broad background. Having become intrigued by the subject, I decided to set off on a worldwide tour and visit a country traditionally associated with alchemy. So I went to China, to India, to Egypt, and throughout Europe. It did indeed prove a wonderful philosophical and physical journey, where I met extraordinary people and some wonderful places. I described them in my book, if you can have a look at the page if you wish. But tonight I just really wanted to give you a glimpse really of some of the things I came across. And I do feel that the alchemy is a crucible of ancient wisdom, which we still can appreciate, particularly about our place in the universe and the nature of who we are. What inspired me initially to set up to China was this lady here, who in the middle, she was actually called Lady Di, no half relationship to Princess Di. The T-A-E-A-I. And she was discovered in the 60s in a perfect state of preservation in China. This is her shroud around her body, a silk shroud. And you can see with her three attendants on the right, two immortal envoys coming to greet her. And it was the aim of the Chinese alchemist to try and preserve the body so it would ensure the passage of the soul into the lands of the immortals. I think it's a similar way that mummification took place in Egypt. It was a great desire of the Chinese to achieve immortality, and I think the most interesting thing about this particular case of Lady Di is that Western scientists and Chinese scientists were at the laboratory when they took her out of the shroud, and they found her in a perfect state of preservation, even though she'd been dead for 2,000 body had been dead for 2,000 years. So it was with this, having this intriguing mystery, I set off to go to China and flying over the Himalayas, you become very quickly aware that China is, for people living in the West, a place which has been cut off from us for thousands of years. Although, of course, the Chinese is the center of the world. This is the Great Wall of China, which I suppose reaffirms that uniqueness. But wherever you travel in China, this is in the Beijing, in the Forbidden Palace, you realize that wherever you go, there are palaces of longevity, there are gardens of longevity, there are stones of longevity. It seems to be a sort of collective desire to live long. And obviously this fed into the early development of alchemy. It developed there probably from what we know of at least 1000 BC, but the Chinese do have the tradition that the knowledge of alchemy was brought across the seas by people they called the sons of reflected light, because they seem to have special clothes. So it implies they may well have come with the knowledge from a lost civilization, or an unknown civilization. We find the same thing in Egypt and in India, as we'll see later. But it was through an institute, like I came across that reference to Lady Dai, by the way, in a wonderful work on Chinese science and civilization by a man called Joseph Needham. And he there's an institute, and his name's from Cambridge. And through them, I went to Beijing and was introduced to the Chinese Academy of Science. And this actually, after the Cultural Revolution, they were allowed to use this Yuning Palace of the Mayan 17th century lords. And I spoke to professors and there with translators, as water drips down into a bucket to his wonderful ceiling. But he was so happy to be back studying alchemy again, and he explained that he quickly explained to me that as in the West they have the alchemy of the inner elixir and the outer elixir, that one is working on the spiritual part of the person and the other is trying to prolong life through the use of external elixirs, through minerals, through metals and other medicines. But the aim of the alchemists was what they called the pill of immortality, which is the equivalent to our philosopher's stone. One of the ways of preserving the body was to bury the deceased in a jade suit, because they thought jade had this wonderful ability to preserve the body. And Lady Di, by the way, was found with a jade amulet in her mouth. For similar reasons. And as I said, the key is to try and preserve the body so that they can actually then meet the immortals in heaven. Why are people so obsessed by wanting to be immortal, you might ask? Well, I think that it's a universal part of death anxiety, but just in a way where, in the world of an Irish playwright, we are born astride the grave. You know, we're born, we live, we die, we can't avoid it. So it's in some ways understandable that people would want to prolong their life. And it's possible to become immortal in some other world. But the alchemists are not just interested simply in prolonging life to carry on enduring this world. They want to prolong their lives, to have more time to become enlightened, so that they then can enter the land of the immortals. This is very much this background to Chinese Upbringing is very much in Taoism. This is at the White Cloud Monastery in Beijing, which is the centre of Taoism now today in northern China. It was turned into a barracks during the Cultural Revolution, but the person in charge appreciated the ancient philosophy, ancient Chinese philosophy of Taoism. And as you're probably all familiar, that you can see all these flags here, that the Taoists believe that there is a unity of all things. We call the Tao. The Tao can't be spoken about. It can only be sensed. So how can a frog, for instance, and a whale understand the ocean? It's beyond our comprehension. But it can be sensed, and the Tao divides into two principles of yin and yang, represented in the flag here between the white and the black. But originally, those two words come from the sunny and sunless Tao of the mountain, the words for sunny and sunless Tao of the mountain. And they link to the male and female principles. But the notion is that we have both within us, the sun can get out of balance. So as the abbot explained to me, and this is actually one of the monks who was an incense burner, but the abbot explained to me that my fellow is an alchemist. He said, we're all alchemists here, we're all practicing alchemists. That they not only work in the laboratory, but they do principally work on themselves, that's developing the inner elixir. And I asked him how he was doing that. He said, what we want to do is we want to try and in ourselves recover the original primal unity of the Tao. I won't go into all the technical details, but he quickly ran through three aspects of being human in his view. One was that the whole there's energy everywhere, qi. And it's not only in the universe, but also within us. Obviously, things like acupuncture are trying to ensure that the free circulation of qi in the body, and also the geomancers in I'm sure he's trying to do that in nature as well. But he said we need to try and preserve our qi, if possible, through different techniques. One technique is through breathing, try and bring our breathing right down so that we can breathe like a fetus. And we also need to be careful of what he called the qing, which is sometimes translated as vital essence. It's also linked to male and female sexuality. And the idea is to preserve it and not waste it. So you can then achieve the qing from the lower part of the body can rise up through the body and nourish the brain, is how they explained. And then thirdly, that he said that we all consist of qen, which is a form of qi, qen which is sometimes translated as soul. But it's not quite as if the soul is separate from the body, as in our Western tradition. But it's almost like a rarefied form of matter. So the view is that when we die, that this part of us does actually continue, but in a very rarefied way. So it's not entirely separate from the body, but a much more rarefied form. And again, so we can develop that the soul side of it through meditation. But the complete person, he says, is really we have to breathe in a particular way. We have to do certain gentle exercises, and you have to breathe in a particular way, and also certain sort of sexual techniques. And there's a vast literature on so-called pillow books, which go into this. All developing out the Taoist tradition, all part of trying to develop the inner elixir. And it is an extraordinary interesting body thinking, which I go into in the book. This is a female alchemist, and they were very important in China. Particularly, I think that the Taoism has a very almost receptive, almost female approach, traditionally female approach to nature. Needham, for instance, one I mentioned earlier, he argued that science developed early in China because of this Taoist approach to nature, which is much more open and intuitive and receptive. As one of the Lao Tzu that said, the valley spirit never dies, and the valley spirit is female. And the great alchemist, the 4th century Po Hung, he just said, it's simple really, clean the mirror of the mind, maintain a feminine approach, and embrace unity, embrace Tao. So there you have it. And another man who might achieve this was Wei Guiyang, with his dog. You can see at the bottom his crucible. That he is known to have he declared that lead is black outside, yet within it carries golden flower, and that's true of lead. It's also true of ourselves. And he went up a sacred mountain famously, and having discovered the pill of immortality, and took it with his dog and disappeared. So let's just give you a little taste of Chinese which I then moved on to India, and this is the Ganges, the dawn. And as in Indian civilization does seem to have developed separately from Chinese, but later on there are the connections in the earlier days, but they again have a tradition that alchemy is brought across the sea to India by seven seeders, or realized ones, who are linked with the Pleiades, sometimes called the seven sisters in our astronomy. But in the earliest texts of India, the Vedas, they talk about the search for Amrit, which is sometimes translated as nectar of immortality. They say you can get it from the soma plant. And where that's to be found, I haven't yet discovered. But we are now on the Ghat, having been on the Ganges at all, we're now on the Ghat in Varanasi, which used to be called Benares, which is claimed to be the oldest and holiest city in India. But every morning people come down and transform themselves by purifying themselves in the holy waters of the Ganges. And at certain astrologically right times, 30 million people come down to the Kumbh Mela to do the same thing. And part of this spiritual alchemy, part of this desire to transform the gross body into a subtle body, which the Buddhist tradition calls the diamond body. But as in China, alchemy seems to be very much a living tradition in India. And this is a temple in the Benares Hindu University in Varanasi. And there is a patent on this here which says that there was an alchemical experiment that took place in the 40s with various professors present. And I went to the university hospital and met a surgeon there, and I went into his room, I could see all these traditional alchemical instruments and around on the wall, changing the walls. He said, come in, we're all mercurials here. In fact, part of the ancient tradition of Indian medicine, Ayurveda, is called the science of longevity, the science of prolonged life. And the key element of it is that Vasayana, which is the Hindu name for alchemy, which means the way of mercury. Mercury is the key substance they use for their base matter, which they then try and transform into gold. But they also use it alchemically processed. They also use it in medicines. But they, while the Russians are using external elixirs in medicine, they're very much part of the Ayurvedic tradition, which a lot of people are now becoming more and more interested in, concerns also the inner elixir. And so before having an operation or even having some surgery at the university hospital, for instance, you'll go on a process of meditation on a special diet, breathing, to prepare yourself for it. In fact, very much like the ancient Greeks, Hippocrates, do the similar techniques in the old days, which again we've rather lost, although now we're becoming more and more interested in it. So I'm afraid the slides are a bit dark. From my angle, I can't see that very well. But this man is his name is called Guru Swami Prakash. And he actually is a tantrika. He's a practitioner of tantra. And tantric alchemy is part of that development of the inner elixir, the inner alchemy. Yoga means, probably know, means union with the cosmos. Tantra, the word tantra comes from the word tan, which means to stretch or to weave. And those interested in tantra are concerned with weaving themselves with the cosmos, so that the individual self becomes part of the absolute. But it is again part of an ancient tradition of Indian alchemy, in which there are two sides. There's the left, I won't go into too much detail, but there's the right handed side, which is just detachment from the world. Leading an aesthetic life, in which the individual tries to unite two male and female principles within him, which are represented by the god Shiva and the goddess Shakti. I'll show you some in a minute some symbols of those. That's actually. When I come back to that. We can see on the left here, that's an image of Shakti, who Shiva is sometimes described as consort. On the right, the elephant-headed statue is Ganesh, who's a god of threshold. He's also the god of astrology, which is very much part of alchemy. So with that astrology you can choose the right times for experiments. You also can make sure that the constellations influence in a beneficial way different aspects of the body. But Shiva, who is the god of alchemy, is one of the three main gods in India. You have Brahma, who's the creator god, and then you have Vishnu, the preserver, and then you have Shiva, who is sometimes called the destroyer, or he's more the transformer, because he is involved in matter dying and then being reborn. So the cycle continues of being recreated, preserved, and then dying. And Mercury, the name of the Mercury is called the seed of Shiva. But what the tantricans try to achieve, those of the right hand part who are through withdrawing from the world, they try and achieve bring together within them Shiva and Shakti, the male and female principles, so they can recover the original unity, just as the the Chinese alchemist tries to bring together yin and yang. And those on the left hand path engage in the world, and they also engage in sex, and sex becomes very much part of the tantric tradition in a very ritualized way, where the partners engaged in it are transforming themselves from the gross body into the subtle body and achieving this sort of cosmic unity. And in order to achieve that, they try and raise what we call kundalini energy, which is, I go back a bit, the symbol of, which is often seen as a coiled serpent at in the bottom, the base of our spine, which through these various, through sex and other rituals, one can raise the, and through meditation and breathing, one can raise this energy through the various centers of the body, through the chakras, until it reaches the head, and then flourishes and in a thousand petals lotus. And at that moment, then one, if it's correctly performed, one is said to become part of the Absolute and enlightened. This is now this temple actually is devoted to tantric tradition. In Kajuraho, it's 11th century, there's a whole series of temples there. And they, you can see as you go up from the base to the top, the actual statues become more and more refined. And some people just say they're just erotic. In fact, they are very much part of this they're more than just erotic, they're also part of this ritualized sex, which is involved in raising kundalini energy so that one can refine oneself. This Ayurvedic tradition and alchemy tradition and tantra is not only within Hinduism but also within Buddhism, and this is at Sarnath, where Buddha gave his first sermon on the Four Noble Truths about the inevitable existence of suffering in the world, but also recognizing there's a way out of it through people, the Eightfold Path, which I won't go into, but very much part of it is right speech, right action, right thinking. But also he, having himself gone from one extreme to the other, he recommended a middle path to try and escape suffering. And it's just near here, this is the part of the Bodhi tree under which he went and found enlightenment. Was taken from a branch. But also at Sarnath is the centre of the centre for higher Tibetan studies. And I spent some time there with this monk and scholar called Mungu Shastri. And he taught me about the Buddhist approach to spiritual alchemy, which he saw he sees it as alchemy as well. And it's concerned with dissolving the negative aspects within us, such as fear and anger, and developing the positive aspects of clear seeing, loving kindness, and calm abiding, which this man certainly seemed to have. I mean, the first time I met him, he was very calm. The next morning I met him, he had a terrible accident on his scooter, and there was no less calm and cheerful. So I thought he was certainly a simplicity and grace of man. And but in his particular case, it's primarily through meditation, and ultimately realizing that we actually have no self in the sense of a grasping, craving, possessive self, that you try and work towards a state of understanding where we no longer recognize that we have a self, because we are part of the universal self. It's only in that very moment you understand that, then you will no longer have to go through the endless cycle of being reborn and achieve nirvana. But before I come to Egypt, my next course of call, is that on the Tibetan Center for Higher Studies, I've also met the doctors there, one man who's a particularly good friend of his. And they said, they said, we are practicing alchemists as well. And he showed me his furnace, where he was trying to work with mercury, and he was processing it in an ancient traditional alchemical way and using them in the medicines, which he thought enhanced their value. And he was convinced that one day he might be able to discover the nectar of immortality. So in the West, of course, mercury is a poison in its normal state. It's processed, it can be changed, and in the Buddhists mix it with different herbs to change it. But there was a famous quip saying that one life with Venus could mean a lifetime with mercury, because mercury was used for syphilis in the 19th century. moving over to in my rapid tour here tonight, to Egypt. So Egypt is called the Mother of Magicians, and it is the crucible of Western alchemy. And Plato famously said that we Greeks, compared to you Egyptians, are mere infants. And they too have an ancient tradition that the knowledge was brought across the seas by the companions of Horus. And I think that the founding myth of Egyptian civilization is that of is at the centre of alchemy, which is the Western alchemy, which is the idea that Osiris, the god Osiris, was killed by one of his sons, Seth. His other son was Horus. And his wife, his son killed him and distributed his parts all over Egypt. Then Osiris, his wife, came and found the parts and put them together and gave him new life. You get that process of dissolution, combination. In all our chemical experiments, you see it right through. Also, you'll see it in the art in the gallery as you leave here tonight. So they call it dissolution and coagulation. But the Sphinx is sometimes said to be older than the pyramids, possibly because it's lined up with certain near constellation, because Solomon has argued it's 10,000 years BC it was founded, and that around the base you can see water erosion, which only happened about 10,000 years ago. If we enter Zwei, underneath the Sphinx there is a hollow chamber, and some are arguing that it may well contain secrets of alchemy. Who knows? But I was fortunate enough to get permission when I was over there to go into the subterranean chamber, which is closed to the public, and also to try and enshrine the pyramid. But here I live, the empty sarcophagus in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid. And most people have said that the pyramids were built simply as tombs of the pharaohs. But I think it's much more than simply a tomb of a tyrant or some great lord. Within the pyramid and this other pyramid, I had a real sense that they were laboratories of the spirit, in which they were designed so that the deceased would be transformed. And in fact, there are shafts in the Great Pyramid which are directly linked to certain stars, which some have argued aim the dead bearer's soul to the heavens. This is a famous golden coffin of Tutankhamun, and it's all made of solid gold. You might ask why did the archivists why they're so keen on gold, and you know why should be gold better than say lead? I think the view is that, and I suppose that I can understand why, that gold is very special. It's very rare in nature. It involves a lot of labour to mine, and then when it is processed, it's malleable. It doesn't perish, and of course it shines like the sun. So it does have this very special value from property about it. And I think that's why they use gold when they mummified the bodies within, because it was thought by preserving the body it would enable the passage of the soul into the afterlife more easy. But the whole of Egyptian civilization religion is geared towards rebirth, and we can see here Anubis attending a mummified pharaoh, the jackal-headed god who is the guide to the underworld. And here we have Thoth, with the Ida-headed god, giving Nank, which is the symbol of rebirth, to a pharaoh. And Thoth was a man in Egyptian religion who recorded one's actions at the final judgment. When you died, according to the Egyptians, that your actions would be weighed in the balance with a feather. And if you were found wanting, then you would die a second death, and then forever. But if your action hadn't been too bad, then you would then pass with Anubis, the jackal-headed god, into the underworld and face all sorts of trials and tribulations. If you came through that experience whole and steady, then there's a good chance of you being able to fly with Ra, the sun god. Or rather sail with Ra, the sun god, on the boat of a million years across the sky. And you could also choose what form you wanted to be a bird or an alligator, or a crocodile, depending on what experience you wish. But Thoth is important because he comes for the Greeks, Hermes. Thoth was the god of the Egyptian god of wisdom, and Hermes becomes the father of alchemy, and hence the word hermetically sealed containers and in the Hermetic tradition. This is a sunset on the Nile, and the word alchemy comes from a Coptic word meaning the black land. It refers to Egypt, and the reason why it does is I think because every year you have the flood, and there's black silt, alluvial silt, which is placed which floods over the banks, and that provides the fertile soil for the grain on which the whole of Egyptian civilization is based. And it's also an annual symbol of death and rebirth. And it was that tradition comes from in the West, comes from Egypt, and it was the alchemical insights were first written down about 200 BC in Alexandria, and it was an amazing mix of Egyptian religion and Greek science and philosophy. But as far as people in Britain were concerned, no one knew that all these things were going on. And it wasn't until the Arabs conquered southern Europe, particularly in Sicily and above all in Spain, and here we're in the courtyard of lions at the Alhambra Palace in Granada in southern Spain. It was the Arabs who occupied Spain from about the 8th to the 15th century who translated all the texts from Greek, which into Latin, and it was only through them that alchemy reached Europe. They also had a very tolerant atmosphere and encouraged learning, and they made some very major contributions themselves to science and to mathematics. And you can see in their writings, and the writings which they translated from Alexandria, which had been written in Greek, you can see the whole alchemical process written down, which is all the principal aspects of it. First being that they are looking for some mysterious substance, the philosopher's stone, to transform base matter into gold. They also talk about a chemical wedding, which is bringing a male and female principles together. By bringing those together, and then as bringing yin and yang, or Shiva and Shakti together, the idea that one can create a larger whole. That's part of the alchemical process to do that. They also recognized the process that there would be a stage of dissolution, and then the stage of coagulation. So you'd be going from nemesis to synthesis. And finally, they also recognized the different stages of alchemy as changing of colours, and this, as I say, was found in Alexandria, and it's brought over by the Arabs. And you can see it can work in some of the wonderful paintings down in the Kew Gallery. But the colours go from black to white to yellow, and then to a reddish violet. And many people have seen these various even in personal transformation stages in that process of transformation. They also, the Arabs also introduced, this is again one of the rooms in the Alhambra, that they also translated from a very important text, was translated from Arabic into Latin, which is called the Emerald Tablet. And here again you see the basic principles, the sort of philosophical backgrounds, if you like, of Western alchemy. And the first is the principle that there is a web of correspondences between heaven and earth, and that's sometimes encapsulated in the phrase as above, so below. There's also a belief that the microcosm of the human being mirrors the macrocosm of the universe. Again, the phrase as within, so without reflects that understanding. And of course, the Arabs also making not only contributing by bringing the texts from the Middle East, make their own contributions. They also wrote in a very, very opaque and mysterious style to make sure that they didn't get into their own hands, hence the name gibberish. And through this, this is the gateway of the sun in Toledo, It was through their countless manuscripts that came to Europe from translated from Arabic and Hebrew into Latin and in the 12th century. And it spread out throughout Europe, and alchemy became the mainstream science, the Middle Ages, and great thinkers such as St. Aquinas and Roger Bacon and Albertus Magnus were all involved both in the experiment and and this is a picture of another source of alchemy. Western alchemy was also through returning crusaders from the Middle East, and this is a Chartres cathedral. There was just as alchemy came to Europe, there was an explosion in the 12th century in Gothic cathedrals in France. Some have even argued that the way did this enormous wealth came from to build such wonderful structures. Some have argued it through that the Knights Templar helped pay for it through alchemical gold. But what does seem to be what is still very intriguing is that the red and blue stained glass in Chartres Cathedral, for instance, no one has ever been able to match. There's some secret recipe there, which is said possibly to have come from Persian alchemists, but it's now lost. This is an alchemist looking down from the towers of Notre Dame in Paris with his hat. If you go into during the Renaissance, alchemy both became quite central but also quite controversial. But this is a wonderful floor, a marble carving, right on the threshold of Siena Cathedral. With Hermes, who's now called Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes Thrice Greatest. You know, he's thought transformed by the Greeks into Hermes, and now becomes a key figure in European Renaissance. And here he's dressed as an Oriental sage, and is said to be a contemporary of Moses. And on the plaque with the winged sphinxes, it's written that the wisdom of Egypt has a divine origin. Many Hermetic texts were actually translated into Italian and Latin after the fall of Constantinople. That the church had a very mixed attitude towards it. On the one hand, it became officially forbidden. Many cardinals and even popes were involved in alchemy. And this is, I think, quite revealing, because we're right in the middle of St. Peter's Square in the Vatican, an Egyptian obelisk with a cross placed on the top. So you get right at the centre of Christendom, whether it's in Siena, as you enter Siena Cathedral, or here in the Vatican, you get the Hermetic tradition, the wisdom of Egypt, there. And I managed to visit a necropolis which exists underneath St. Peter's, which only discovered around about the Second World War, and not known of. It's very difficult to enter, but it's right under the altar, the central altar and the dome of St. Peter's. And within it you can see that it's a pagan necropolis, and you can see it's fading quickly, the images of on the frescoes of Horus and Osiris, the ancient Greek, Egyptian gods. So you get layers of, if you like, architecture that reflect layers of thought in the Western tradition, and it is still at the heart of Christendom. We are moving to Prague, and in the 16th, 17th century, the 16th century, where the Holy Roman Emperor, who was meant to be the most powerful man on earth within the Christian world, Rudolf II became deeply involved in alchemy and almost lost his insanity, and certainly his empire. in the search for the philosopher's stone. He invited some wonderful thinkers all over Europe, like John Dee from Britain, Polish alchemist Sendugovius, who discovered oxygen, and then the Danish prince Tycho Brahe and the German mathematician Kepler, who founded the new astronomy. And Newton talks about them as being giants on whose shoulders he stands. But these men were all involved in alchemy. And it promised not only ability to change nature, but also to change oneself and achieve a state of enlightenment. Also came to Prague. This incident was that round building, the Powder Tower, which was Rudolf II's laboratory. One man who came here at the time was Giordano Bruno, who was a very ancient thinker, who actually was executed by the Inquisition, 1600, a key date. I suppose the Vice Chancellor of the Vatican University, he's known as what you call alchemy and all those dangerous things. What he was arguing for was a much more organic view of the world, which they thought sounded too Egyptian. But here we have, and I'm coming towards the end now, a Renaissance alchemist in his study laboratory. And it says, Ora et Labora, on one of the signs you can't see, which work, praying work, because those two aspects were still very important between the spiritual and the practical, between the inner and outer alchemy. The feel for the new interest and perspective being exploited. But the alchemists, as they were originally in Alexandria in the 15th and 16th century, were still concerned about trying to achieve this chemical wedding between Sol and Luna, Sun and Moon, who represented not only the male and female principles, but also mercury and sulfur. It was thought that all metals contained a degree of different combinations of mercury and sulfur, and that if you get the mix right, then you would be able to create the philosopher's stone. To then be able to use to transform base metal into gold. By bringing them together in this alchemical process, it was thought you would form a hermaphrodite, which was both male and female. This is the actual coming together in the chemical wedding, in the waters of dissolution, which would probably means you're putting mercury and sulfur in some sort of acid. Out of this process, you get hermaphrodite, which is the Aquinas pointing it out. He was greatly involved in alchemy. Mm-hmm. And beyond that if the two are beyond the hermaphrodite phase, you get the phase of unity, which then produces the philosopher's stone, and this is represented by a man with wings at the top of a mountain. It reminded me of a phrase in a Chinese text called The Secret of the Golden Flower, where it says that if you do become enlightened, you can then sit on the summit of a thousand mountains without leaving the crossroads. These seem to be quite dull to me. You can see them, but this is, in some ways, an engraving of the great work in all its aspects. That the alchemist in the middle is in a wood of metal, and on the left you see Sol, mercury. And on the right there's Luna, or mercury, and the Sol is sulfur. You have a stag-headed figure on the right, who is the seeker of the stone, secret truth. And at the bottom there are two unified lines which again represents the concordance. And on the, you can see how it's very complex symbolism if you don't, you know, don't, if you're not aware of the tradition. And there is also a raven which represents the black initial stage of the alchemical process, and a phoenix which is the final red phase. Finally here we come to an 18th century picture by Darby, by Joseph Wright, of the philosopher Alchemist in Search, the Philosopher's Stone. What he has done here is actually discovered phosphorus, and that the others did make real discoveries. Mm-hmm. They discovered porcelain, oxygen, phosphorus, for example. But with the rise of the although the great founders of the scientific revolution, like Kepler and Newton, and also Robert Boyle, who founded the Royal Society and developed the notion of elements, the modern notion of elements, all these men were alchemists and involved in it. But then in the 18th century, the Age of Reason, that ironically with Newton, the sort of mechanical view of the universe prevailed, the controlled machine universe controlled by a machine maker, God. And this came to dominate Western thought for most of the 18th and 19th century. I'm just jumping not many things here in the history of ideas, but we find in the 20th century that alchemy has re-emerged like a phoenix. And it's especially in the world view of modern science. And for instance, in quantum physics, that they describe, and some of the book written called the Tao of Physics, but it describes matter no longer as some dead object, but as a, well, quantum physics describes it, post-Einstein, as a field of force, or a transforming curl of energy, just in the same way like the ancient Taoists alchemists were describing. And also quantum physics recognizes that the experimenter inevitably influences the experiment. It's called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So that's something which was at the heart of alchemy, that recognition. But you can find in the new science of ecology, which Lovelock will talk about. I think he's recommending a sort of dangerous approach to the nuclear power, but with the ecological view that holistic, organic view of the world, you know, seeing the earth as a self-sustaining, living being, this goes right back to the earliest alchemy. And in particular, recognizing that there's unity and diversity, that ultimately all is one in nature's embracing way. And as I mentioned with Jung, in particular, thought that alchemy could, the symbolism gave him the key to understanding the psyche, and he thought that a lot of these figures were coming through in alchemical writings. And imagery were in fact archetypal figures. They were dealing with very deep impulses in human beings. He also thought the alchemical process of passing through these different colours I mentioned was going from dissolution to coagulation, going from black to white to yellow to red. Those were phases, stages, what he thought, in the process of becoming a fully realized individual, that moving from leaden feelings of depression, anguish, to different phases in which one becomes a whole being again. And so for him, a philosopher's stone was a symbol of wholeness and perfection, which people longed for and could achieve through their own self-development. And finally, of course, in what are complementary and in alternative holistic medicine, it's recognizing, like traditional Chinese medicine and Indian medicine, like the early alchemists, that we have to treat the whole person, the mind, the body, and the soul. Just by way of conclusion, I've sort of gone out of it, rather than I anticipated, that I think we can, what the alchemists today can teach us in particular, is the dangers of manipulating nature without that moral and spiritual dimension, that cosmic awareness that they had. They realized that they were doing something dangerous and something potentially harmful. And in fact, Mary Shelley wrote the Frankenstein, which she says this is a modern Prometheus. Prometheus was the man who stole the fire from the gods and was punished. And he had his liver eaten out every day by vultures and all the eagles, and he was healed in the night. But the parable of the science getting out of hand, not having any boundaries, not having a moral and cosmic dimension. And possibly, you know, with our headlong rush into genetic engineering and, you know, the new interest in nuclear power, that maybe we should remember what alchemists have been teaching throughout the centuries. And indeed, Gaia will no doubt have her revenge if we probe too deeply into the natural processes, if we're not prepared and careful enough. I think alchemy is of interest both East and West, because it does combine science and spirituality, and it experiments and vision, and it can show us also, I think, how to live and long, and how to live well. Finally, you might know whether I found a philosopher's stone. You have to read the book. But there are hints and clues in what you're saying, and I also have to remember about the singer and the song. The singer is not necessarily giving the full meaning of the song, but you may understand it better than the singer. And I think what I can reveal is that the philosopher's stone is a divine spark in us, which can become a candle to illuminate itself. And I think also whatever happens to us, that we can transform ourselves from dead stones to living philosophical stones. And finally, what I have learned, I think, from my searches throughout the world almost, and from the earliest times, is that alchemy does, and may well be, a remnant of a sacred science of our civilization. I have a little mind about that. But I do think it does distill the wisdom of the ages. And that is that we reap what we sow, that life is a preparation to death, and that death is simply another stage in our journeys. And it also has taught me that the understanding that we can all move from ignorance to wisdom, from chaos to harmony, and from darkness to light. Mm-hmm.